polls are open in North Carolina and Indiana, and a closed nation is opened by nature's wrath.
Huge trees had just fallen on the road. Windows were smashed. We saw houses without any roofs.
The view from inside Myanmar is as grim as it is rare this morning. The Burmese people await the international community following a devastating cyclone. The Myanmar junta finds itself under siege in the global politics of humanitarian aid. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 6th. It's primary day once again, and this time 187 delegates are at stake in the latest contests. In Myanmar, also called Burma, government officials have just reported they believe 22,000 people are dead. Aid workers are mobilizing all over the world. We have reports from Yangon to Philadelphia. And a question, when have you given to a cause? What made you give in times of disaster? That question and all the news. Polls are open in North Carolina and Indiana, as John just mentioned. There are reports of long lines in some precincts. After 2 weeks of fierce campaigning, Barack Obama addressed crowds last night in Indiana, and Senator Hillary Clinton rallied at a train station in North Carolina.
That as this train goes by, we think that it's taken us into the future, and we're all going to be on it. Let's go win an election.
And I am here to report that my bet has paid off. We are ready for something new. We are ready to turn the page and write a new chapter in American history.
Latest polls show Obama leading in North Carolina and Clinton leading in Indiana. In the aftermath of Myanmar's tropical cyclone Nargis, UN World Food Program officials estimate up to 1 million people could be homeless. They say entire villages have been leveled and vast rice-growing areas wiped out, with major obstacles for short-term aid. Preventing long-term famine is complicated by the devastation and the political isolation of the country's regime. Laura Bush held her first news conference in 7 years, criticizing Myanmar's leaders for failing to warn people of the massive storm.
I urge the government to accept aid from the United States and from the entire international community right now, while the needs of their people are so critical.
We'll have more on the disaster coming up in a moment.
A few other quick stories. Some ugly numbers this morning for people who bought homes in 2006. The real estate tracking website Zillow.com says more than half of the buyers in 06 owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth now. Georgia is moving forward with preparations to execute a man convicted of killing his girlfriend 20 years ago. It's the first inmate put to death since the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of lethal injection. If it happens, it's scheduled for 7 p.m. Eastern Time. U.S. crude has hit an all-time high of $120.93 a barrel, and the Dow was down 88 points yesterday. We have more news throughout the hour from Femi Oke. Our question today is, when you have moved to give money as a result of a disaster, what was it that moved you?
I guess sort of if I have money on me and if they ask me and I'm able to give, then I would give.
We'd like to hear your story about when you've given. What was the moment you decided to act? What made you act? And we can hear that story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Today, all eyes are on Myanmar after this weekend's deadly cyclone, with more than 22,000 people dead, according to the country's radio reports, and that just came out. An estimated 1 million people are homeless and hundreds of thousands without clean drinking water and very low food supplies. The ruling junta has been criticized for acting too late and helping too little. The director of the UN World Food Program, Chris Ray, told the BBC that time is not on the side of the people of Burma.
we have a major humanitarian catastrophe on our hands, and that numbers of people in need are still to be determined. But for sure, we're talking of hundreds of thousands.
The U.S. has authorized $250,000 in aid, but is prepared to offer more, according to officials, if a disaster assistance team is allowed into the country to assess the need. To tell us more about what's happening in Burma now, we're joined by the BBC's Daniel Griffith in Bangkok. Daniel, what can you tell us that's happened today?
Well, this now appears to be the worst cyclone to hit Asia in nearly 20 years, the last really big one being in 1991, when 143,000 people died in Bangladesh. And the figures just keep on growing. 22,500 people, state media reporting just under that figure. And they're also saying that an additional 41,000 people are missing. And what is really worrying is that officials say they expect that figure to rise further as they get through to some of the areas that have been cut off by the cyclone.
And what are you hearing, since you're really not that far away, a neighbor there to Myanmar, about whether or not the government is allowing advocacy, nonprofit, and others who are responding to this emergency to go into the country?
Well, this is really the big one of the big challenges at the moment. We've been speaking to aid workers both here and in Burma as well. And certainly one of their concerns is just how much room for maneuver, how much access are the Burmese authorities going to give aid workers. Don't forget that Burma placed restrictions on foreign aid workers in 2006 that restricts their movement. Now, what sort of room for movement and room for maneuver are the authorities going to give aid workers this time? That is going to be one big challenge. The second big challenge is just the logistics of getting aid to some of these areas. One aid worker we were speaking to in Burma said that they'll need boats and planes just to get to some of these areas. He told us that initially they were planning an operation that they thought would need to last 2 months. Now they're thinking about an operation that will need to last 2 years. So that gives you an idea of the challenge facing the international aid community and the Burmese authorities at the moment.
Daniel, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a moment because we're going to bring in the New York Times' Seth Maidan, who's also been reporting on this story. And Seth, you talk about how their food sources are running out as well as water sources.
That's what I'm hearing from people in Yangon, the major city there. Everything is short. Food, water, electricity, communications. Water's being sold from trucks that are dredging it out of local lakes. Food is running out. People are fearing that that they really will go without. At the same time, prices are skyrocketing, and one of the government ministers has already been appealing to entrepreneurs and businessmen not to cash in on the disaster and profiteer, which already seems to be happening.
Seth, we've lost Daniel Griffith from the BBC, but he was mentioning a moment ago that this was an operation, a relief operation, that's going to take years. And it seems to me, at the very least, this is an extraordinary test of the government's control of the civil population. You've just mentioned sort of a call to keep people from looting. But there's a lot more politically at stake here in terms of the government being able to project its control over the people of Burma.
That's true. This could be one of the big events in a long history of non-events in Burma over the last 20 years or so. Last September, we had a major crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators, repeating something that had happened in 1988, and very little has changed. The government just keeps control by force, and there's not much that civilians can do against that force. However, now, with the extent of this need and the extent of foreign assistance that apparently is going to be coming into the country, the government is not going to be able to control things quite as tightly. And a major foreign presence could take root in the country, which will be something that they have tried to keep away for all of these years.
Okay, Seth Maidans, we're going to be continuing to follow this story, as you are. Very huge thanks for you're giving us some more perspective as to what's happening.
Seth Maidens,
the New York Times.
In Bangkok. Now we move to primary day in North Carolina and Indiana. There are 187 delegates at stake in those two states, and 72 of them are in Indiana. Boy, it seems like Super Tuesday was a million years ago. States like Indiana are certainly grateful that they didn't move their primaries forward and receive some bonus delegates as a result. Mike Puente covers northwestern Indiana for Chicago Public Radio and joins us from Crown Point, Indiana, a city near the Illinois border. Mike, people of Indiana have, you know, by not moving their primary and by having a late primary, are suddenly in the middle of a contest that truly is meaningful in an election that has been unprecedented in every sort of level.
That's right. Actually, it was 40 years ago when the last time a presidential candidate even visited northwest Indiana, or Indiana for that matter. And that was because 40 years ago, Indiana actually had their primary up much earlier in the calendar. They moved it back so there wouldn't be any conflicts with some of the state legislators with the election time. So they moved it to May, and, you know, all these many years, we haven't had much of an influence on primaries. And this year, it was terrible because we're right next to Illinois. There's Super Tuesday, and we're all sitting here kind of like, oh, God, we wish we could be part of it. But, yeah, I was kind of thankful that we didn't move it.
As recently as yesterday, a reporter down in Evansville was telling us that statewide, well over 100,000 additional new registered voters are at least potentially on their way to the polls today. Any evidence of that where you are?
Oh, yeah, there's been a tremendous amount of people signing up for the first time. And one of the issues that could affect first-time voters is this issue that you need a photo identification to vote in Indiana. And that's a law that was passed a few years ago, and it was just recently upheld by the United States Supreme Court just not even a month ago. Excuse me.
That's a really interesting point that you bring up, because we actually covered that story. And I guess the question would be, do people understand that? Was that information widely distributed so that everyone in Indiana knows if they're going to show up at the polls today, they must have a government-issued identification, not just any kind of identification, but a passport, a license, something of that nature?
Well, the Secretary of State of Indiana, Todd Rokita, he's been making the point that there's been a lot of educational materials out there. They've had media ads out there. So they're trying to get the point across that you do need this. He makes the point that there's already been 7 elections that have passed since then, and with very few problems, if any problems, with this photo identification rule. And if somebody shows up at the polling site and does not have a photo ID, they can still cast what's called a provisional ballot, but they would have to return to a county office within the next, I believe, 10 days to make that vote count. Now, how many people would actually return, and, you know, that remains to be seen. There's some areas in northwest Indiana, for example, the city of Gary, which is supposed to be a stronghold for Barack Obama, but they've had notorious of very low voter participation in recent primaries, recent elections. And this may be a little different, but you would think there may be some issues regarding first-time voters in this photo identification law.
And it does have to be a government-issued ID. That press pass that's hanging around your neck isn't going to be any help, right?
That's right. You need a driver's license or some kind of government-issued identification.
All right, quickly, will the polls close when tonight?
They close at 6 p.m.
All right, at 6 p.m. So 6 p.m. Central Time, so that's 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Mike Puente of Chicago Public Radio, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Primary day in North Carolina. We'll have a report later on in the hour from North Carolina, but we'd like to remind you that what we're asking for this hour is a story from you. The takeaway question today is, what has ever moved you to actually go from sitting on the fence, watching disaster unfold or a tragedy unfold in your midst, and had you actually give money?
We have one from Marsha, who opened her wallet to relive the pain of imagining what people are going through. What else made me open up my wallet? She says, fear of a Republican being elected in 2008. The first time I ever made a political donation, she says.
Here's another inspirational story here.
I just feel like sometimes the big things are too big, so I try to do what's in front of me. So somebody on the subway, somebody on the street, I need something.
It's inspirational when people overcome their sense of helplessness to actually reach out and give. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's the question today.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Among the takeaway topics we're following this morning, of course, the situation in Myanmar, the fact that it's primary day in North Carolina and Indiana, and I love that fact we reported earlier today. If you bought a house in 2006, there's more than a 50-50 chance you owe more on your mortgage than your home is worth.
I'm sure that's devastating news for those folks who bought those homes. And it's an enormous number. It's quite shocking.
Yes, and it's rising.
And not to mention so is oil prices.
That's right. Well, and speaking of oil prices, at the risk of angering some climatologists, let me remind you all of something, including you, Adora. The Earth is actually not running out of oil. There is plenty of fossil fuel to last for centuries and centuries and centuries. What we are running out of is oil that is easy to get out of the ground, the liquid, easy to pump stuff. But what about energy in hard-to-obtain tar fields and other deposits of oily goo? With the right scientific coaxing, it turns out Canada and Venezuela could be the next Saudi Arabia. Professor Steve Larder of Newcastle University and the University of Calgary says energy-starved humanity has an ally in a very unusual microbe. Professor Larder, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Explain how this microbe is an ally of energy-starved humanity.
Well, what we've been researching for many, many years is the origin of what so-called heavy oil. So as you've been, the kind of oil you've been talking about is what most listeners would be familiar with as a sort of a brown, easily runny liquid, about the same viscosity or runniness as, say, hot tea. What we've been looking at is most of the world's oil, which is a kind of thick, sort of viscous, goopy material that's very hard to recover because it flows very, very slowly. And what we've discovered is that this material is produced in subsurface oil reservoirs by microorganisms actually eating the regular kind of runny type of oil and leaving this residue of horrible, gunky, viscous, heavy oil. And what these organisms do is they actually eat the regular oil by reacting it with water, common old garden water, and in the process they produce methane, natural gas, some carbon dioxide, and the residue they leave is the heavy oil. So
now, is it possible that this microbe could actually produce a useful energy source by turning these tar sands and oily goo into enough natural gas to actually be of use?
Well, that's what we're looking at, and it's not a microbe. It's a whole group of microorganisms all working together.
How have you speeded up the process?
Well, what we're trying to do, and we haven't done it yet, but what we're trying to do is actually essentially do what farmers do, and that's actually fertilize the organisms. So they are running very, very slowly in the subsurface, eating crude oil, producing natural gas, but they're doing it far too slowly for that to be a commercially viable way of recovering natural gas. So one of the things we do is essentially just feed them nutrients, fertilize them with sort of basically very similar materials that farmers would use to fertilize plants.
And what is the amount? Can you give us a sense of what we're talking about? When you say that there is this tar sand, this gooey residue left, how much of it is there out there, and how much would then these microbes be able to affect what's there?
Well, in terms of, just the quantity of this heavy oil and oil sand bitumen, as we call the extremely viscous stuff, there's probably many trillions of barrels. So that's sort of 10 with a 12 exponent. And in Western Canada, for example, there's something like about 1.3 trillion barrels of oil sand bitumen, and you compare that with, say, the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia, which are around 700 billion barrels. So
Wow. That's
twice as much material in Western Canada as there is in Saudi Arabia. Worldwide, there are several trillion barrels of this very viscous heavy oil, and currently the energy industry can recover typically less than about 15% of this material from a typical reservoir.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the scale of this, but one of the interesting and convenient things about Saudi Arabia is that the oil's all nicely packed away in a little cave down under the ground. How would you actually get, if you were able to scale this process up and produce natural gas, how would you keep it from just sort of bubbling away and be kind of stinky and unharvestable?
Well, you've got to remember the oil is in the same kind of reservoir that naturally traps natural gas, too.
So you drill a hole, you pump in some microbes, and then you pump out the gas.
Well, no, even better than that. You've probably already drilled your hole because you've been recovering some oil. The microbes are already down there, so we don't have to get kind of worried about, three-headed monsters coming out of the earth or anything.
I do worry about them, so.
The microorganisms, they're already there. I think what a lot of people don't realize is something like 90% of all the microorganisms on planet Earth are actually in planet Earth. They're actually living in the subsurface at depths down to about 4,000 meters. So they're already there. They're doing their thing. What you would do is you would add some fertilizer, some nutrients down probably already existing well bores. You'd let that soak for a while. You'd speed up that natural process, produce the natural gas, which won't bubble away. It will just partially dissolve in the water and the oil, partially accumulate in that reservoir because that's sealed off, and then later on you just produce it out of another production well.
Well, Professor Larder, that's quite a recipe for dealing with the energy crisis on planet Earth, if not the carbon, climate, global warming problem. Anyway, Professor Steve Larder of the University of Calgary, thank you so much for joining us.
And now, John, we have more headlines from Femi Okeh.
Taking a look at some of the news making news around the world, Iran has called off talks with the U.S. on Iraqi security. Iran's foreign ministry says it won't resume discussions unless the U.S. stops a crackdown against Shiite militias. A ministry spokesman also raised doubts about whether the U.S. is sincerely pursuing security and peace. A fatal hand, foot and mouth disease has struck more than 11,000 people in China, with 26 children dead. Officials have dramatically increased the count in recent days and expect cases to rise in June and July, and that's just right before the Summer Beijing Olympics. Amnesty International says all parties to the conflict in Somalia have continued to carry out violence, including killings, torture and rape. Amnesty's Deputy Programme Director for Africa, Michel Kagari, told Network Africa, that's one of our BBC colleagues, there's an urgent need for pressure on the transitional government and its Ethiopian backers.
The killings need to stop. So the transitional federal government bears primary responsibility. The Ethiopian government needs to look at what's going on. They need to investigate these reports and ensure that their troops stop these killings.
Amnesty International also adds that there's no safety for Somalis wherever they happen to go. And finally, China recently built a bridge to cut down on commute time, but traffic has slowed down because of rubberneckers. They've been stopping to check out the view. Since May the 1st, police have fined more than 300 drivers for checking out the gorgeous bridge.
You said since May 1st?
Yes.
You mean
one day.
Right?
It's China. There are a lot of people in China. That's what we call new news, Adora.
No, that's just amazing in a very short period of time.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, May 6th, and today officials in Myanmar say at least 22,000 people are feared dead and more than 41,000 are still missing after the cyclone that struck over the weekend. That number, unfortunately, is very likely to rise. Aid groups are struggling to get assistance to hundreds of thousands of vulnerable people. Joining us now is Zarmina Nasir. She's a manager for the Emergency Response Unit of CARE. Zarmina, we understand this is a period of assessment. Can you tell me exactly how do you go about this? What's the first thing you think about?
Yes. Hi, Adora. The first 24 hours, Adora, we've got many staff on the ground. CARE has been working in Myanmar for several years now. So the first priority was naturally to make sure that they were all safe because they experienced the cyclone firsthand. And then, as you said, we've just been really focused round the clock now on trying to assess the situation, because this has been a really significant disaster and there's a huge humanitarian impact on communities living in Myanmar. So CARE actually has teams out there in the field at the moment trying to determine what are the most urgent needs and how can we best address those.
How do you accumulate that information in a situation that even in the best of times, telecommunication lines aren't that great, but now many are cut, when buildings have been torn apart, and just navigating through even a small area is very difficult? How do you accumulate the information?
It is extremely challenging, Adora, as you point out. But agencies like CARE do have experience. This is what we do. This is our mandate. So when a natural disaster of this magnitude hits, we're quite well prepared. We've got staff. We've got experience. We always have the advantage that we've been present in these countries and in the communities that have been affected for many years. So we've got really good networks and access. We have a good understanding of what the context already is in those communities. So, for instance, we know at the moment people are going to face a situation with their crops because it's planting season and that's been affected. So we actually have staff who are able to get out there. That said, with a disaster, you know, you have a lot of challenges just purely through logistics. Roads are shut down, debris cuts off areas, buildings, as you mentioned, are damaged. It's really hard to physically get into some of these areas. But as I've said, it's not something new. We do have experience with it. We've seen it in many of the recent natural disasters, so we just try to do the best we can as quickly as we can.
And we really are talking about a very desperate situation. The New York Times and the BBC have been reporting that drinking water and food are in short supply. What are you hearing?
Absolutely the same, Adora. It's significant. You know, the huge thing is on Saturday we were talking 250 people dead. As you see now, the figures are closer to 15,000 informally, 10,000 pretty much confirmed. And hundreds of thousands of people left homeless, without access to health facilities, very urgent needs in terms of safe drinking water and food, and even basic non-food items, you know, because people have lost their homes, so they wouldn't have access to basic household items that they need, sort of hygiene-type items that they need as well.
Zarmina Nasir, Manager, Emergency Response Unit of CARE, many thanks. John, they have a serious situation on their hands, and we'll continue to follow that story.
Sounds like they have some infrastructure inside the country. CARE has been there along with the World Vision we reported earlier, and UN officials are assessing damage and trying to figure out where to go.
So we'll have more on that story later. Moving here to the United States, today in Georgia, officials are scheduled to execute 53-year-old William Lind, who was convicted of brutally murdering two women. If it goes forward, Lind's execution will end a 7-month moratorium on the death penalty, the longest pause in 25 years. It comes after the Supreme Court ruled last month that Kentucky's method of lethal injection, the most commonly used method in the U.S., does not violate the Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. Since then, 14 executions have been scheduled in 6 states starting today. Fordham University law professor Deborah Deno's work was cited by the Supreme Court. Professor, the argument in this case was really about the method, not about the sentence itself.
Well, first of all, this is about Kentucky only. Kentucky's only had one execution. It also has a limited record, so it doesn't really apply to any other state but Kentucky, except for the standard that the court came up with. But the court didn't find enough evidence that this single barbiturate was had been sufficiently tested. And, you know, during oral arguments, there was some consideration that maybe there wasn't enough evidence at all collected to show that.
Now, it's interesting because the justices came down 7-2, which would seem like a decisive decision, but that's actually misleading, right? Because there were many differing opinions, even for the majority who were all agreeing on the end result.
That's right. There wasn't any opinion that had more than three justices, and you had, you know, five concurrences, which is extraordinary. So you had a concurring opinion is where a justice would agree with the result but has their own reasoning for why they're coming out the way they are. So it was very splintered, and it's hard to get an exact read on the opinion for that reason.
And so what does that mean? In essence, this issue has not been clarified, right?
Well, it's been clarified to the extent that the court came down with an Eighth Amendment standard for states to follow, and that's the good news. The bad news is that states can, you know, the standard is still a little bit murky, and states can interpret it, and there will still be a lot of litigation going on forward.
And another issue here is, won't this decision force the medical community to confront the death penalty once again, although this is something the American Medical Association has tackled and other medical organizations? What does this mean for them?
Well, it means for them that, you know, in all states now, doctors can participate in executions, and it could resume the kind of conflict that you're talking about, you know, this paradox where the best people who are qualified to conduct an execution are ethically prohibited from doing so, even though we know that many doctors have been involved in these executions.
Deborah Denno, Fordham University School of Law. I should say from Fordham University School of Law. Thank you very much. Now we're going to move on to more headlines, and that's Femi Okey's job. Femi?
It's almost 20 to the hour, and the primary day polling has already begun in Indiana and North Carolina. Several precincts in Raleigh are reporting lines as long as 200 people this morning. In Indianapolis, polling officials say they had a record early voting and expect heavy turnout today. And also out in North Carolina, as many as 13% of people have already put in their vote. As we head back to Myanmar, aid is pouring in from around the world to help with the tropical cyclone there, one of the worst in the last 20 years. The U.S. Embassy in Myanmar was already providing $250,000 from an emergency fund. Singapore says it will provide $200,000. China's president and Australia's foreign minister also pledge assistance. The European Union says it will provide $3 million in humanitarian aid as well. And meanwhile, a quick look at sports. The Olympic torches trip around the world has been very troubled. And now a mountain is slowing it down. That's Mount Everest. A spokesman for the mountaineering team, Zhang Zijiang, says storms have destroyed important equipment.
The heavy snowfall in the past 2 days has destroyed the ropes we have fixed and also the camps that we have built in the mountain. Our climbing torchbearers are busy trying to repair them.
That's a tough one, trying to get the Olympic torch up Mount Everest. This story will run and run.
That's thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Welcome back. We are talking about what it is, the story of what happened to you when you decided to actually give to a cause, be it a disaster, be it a charity of some sort. Imagine if you were just getting some money out of an ATM in Lower Manhattan and our producer Jim Colgan came up and started asking you the annoying takeaway question that is ours today.
If you could tell me, when's the last time you opened your wallet and gave to a cause, whether it was a global catastrophe or a person on the street?
I give regularly to a temple, a Buddhist temple, and every month I give to a Tibetan monk in India, and also a little boy in Africa.
It was about 2 weeks ago in the military. Army has a fund that we give money to every month.
Last month for the colon race for the Central Park.
When was the last time I donated money to a cause? I'd say around Christmas time.
And what was it?
Salvation Army.
We've been giving and getting some interesting responses, very much like some of that sound that you just heard that Jim collected. And Atu in New York City tells us, I gave some money to the Republic of Mozambique when they had this flood, or the flood, I should say. And a woman gave birth from the top of the tree. I'm sure many of you remember that story. At the time, she had nothing, and I thought she needed to have some money to take care of the baby. So I sent the money to the embassy in New York.
So I don't remember that story. There was a woman.
A couple of years ago in Mozambique, there were terrible, terrible floods. And literally entire chunks of the country were underwater.
And somehow there were television
pictures.
And
there was a woman in a tree, and she was 8 months pregnant, and she literally gave birth. And rescue workers were helping her. My husband actually reported on that story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, won an Emmy.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, one of the stories that we got addresses an issue that I'm always puzzled about in charitable giving, and that is, so how do celebrities trigger people to open their wallets? And Andrea in Brooklyn says, I'm a huge George Clooney fan, and it was his involvement in the telethons following 9/11 and the tsunami that compelled me to start contributing to those in need. My first gift was to the Red Cross, and since then I have continued to give to World Aid organizations. It just goes to show that celebrities can make a difference, certainly in Andrea's
What do you
life.
Find perplexing about that? Sometimes if someone you admire or you like or you find interesting is talking about a cause or a situation you know nothing about, now you're exposed to the fundamentals of that situation and it might touch you in some way. Why wouldn't that happen?
I don't know. It was like talking about Tom Hanks yesterday, you know.
You mean
why does a celebrity?
Obama.
Yeah, why does a celebrity give greater credence to something that seems to be on its face fairly obvious? There's a tsunami. Maybe you should give some money. Oh, George Clooney says we should.
But
give
I think
some money.
We're human
I love
beings,
George.
And we respond to that interactive call out, if you will.
Yeah,
when you hear something, I mean, look, people are busy, and when things are presented to you in a way where there's actually something you can do where you feel like you're part of the solution,
that's fine.
As opposed to the problem, then that can be.
Yeah, I just don't
you can
know
be
why.
Inspired from lots of different places.
No, that's true. It's just like, I don't know if Angelina Jolie makes the argument better. We have politics coming
up. We do.
Coming up. And, you know, my anti-celebrity screed can be found on our website at thetakeaway.org. But, polls are open in Indiana and North Carolina. When we come back, we will go to North Carolina.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It seems like we've been saying this for years, but after today, when the voting is done today, we may know a lot more about who's going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party.
Or not.
But it is true that North Carolina and Indiana are the biggest last states in the primary contest. Between now and January, it gets smaller and smaller, the delegates at stake. There are 187 at stake today.
Most of them in North Carolina, actually.
Most of them in North Carolina.
72 in Indiana.
And then
there's a mix in North Carolina, which is their fundamental delegate allocation, and then they got an additional 25 because
bonus
they
delegates,
were
yep.
one of the states that did not move their primary forward.
There are the procedural questions in North Carolina and Indiana. There are, of course, the polls. North Carolina seems to favor Barack Obama. Indiana is neck and neck. And I think we all yearn, as this campaign has gone on so long, to find fresh perspective and a fresh sort of look at how this race is unfolding. There are record turnouts in every state, as every state in this campaign process has been called to do something really decisive. It's really been unprecedented. And the New York Times has come up with an interesting sort of way of giving us a fresh set of eyes on at least the North Carolina race. Campbell Robertson joins us. He's a reporter with the Times. And not only is he reporting on the North Carolina primary, he's actually drawing about it as well. You're a cartoonist, correct?
I'm a cartoonist. Well, I mean, amateur.
Amateur, yeah, right. They're not paying you at the Times?
not for cartooning, really, just for the reporting part.
How does both your perspective as a non-kind of hard-bitten political reporter, as someone who's more of an arts reporter, and your skills as someone who sketches, How does that add to your ability to convey things that maybe are hard to convey in sound bites on this campaign?
Well, I mean, the idea, they have sort of man-to-man reporters who do the campaign and the political and the strategy stuff, and then they kind of have zone reporters who just go to the state and talk to normal folks and try to avoid the big events and campaign rallies. And that's sort of what I'm doing, and just kind of walking around talking to people. I don't know that the cartoon part, I'm sort of not pretentious to know that it adds anything. It's just I think sometimes if it's drawn, that you sort of refocus on things and you maybe look a little bit longer. And with people saying sort of the same thing all over the country, you know, complaining about the economy and price of gas and the price of food, you know, sometimes you need to sort of re-engage with what people are talking about.
Well, the images do something for me. I mean, I don't think it's pretentious to say that, you know, the evidence of you looking longer, I think, is there in the images because a voice of North Carolina appears to come out of them. How does that work?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I think you look longer, even though people may be saying the same thing in Carolina as they did in Pennsylvania and Ohio. I think if you draw these pictures, sometimes it sort of allows you to even focus on the little details a little bit longer than you might otherwise have. And in that sense, it sort of, you know, I mean, these are real problems people are having, and I think that sort of freshens and keeps it right. A little bit real.
Campbell, you're actually on a mission, right? I mean, you're from the South, and you were really trying to give some insight into the state of North Carolina, where, on one hand, it elects Democrats in local elections, it elects Democrats, but in national elections, voters there choose Republicans.
It's a really quirky state politically. I mean, there's this whole class of Democrats called Jessecrats, and they, you know, would send Democrats,
referring to Jesse Helms, right?
They'd send Democrats to the governor's mansion and Jesse Helms to the Senate. And, you know, they're all over the state. And I think that's actually the group that the Clinton campaign is courting the most heavily. But it's a bizarre state politically just because of that. I mean, it's got more Democrats, way more Democrats than Republicans registered. But, you know, again, Jesse Helms probably the most conservative senator in recent history, they kept sending him up there.
You know, Campbell, the other thing that comes through in your images, and I don't think it comes through in much of the other coverage, is that, you know, you hear year after year that, you know, the primary season is about the activists. It's about the political aficionados, the people who are dialed into politics, and the rest of the state kind of doesn't really pay attention to the primary contest. This year, it's really penetrated into the mom and pop kitchen table world of North Carolina, and that's what comes through in some of your cartoons.
Well, Bill Clinton's been under everybody's table. I mean, he's everywhere a dog walks. It's so amazing. The Obama campaign has this grassroots network. You go into so many, he has 37 offices, and you go into so many small towns, and there'll be these Obama people who started up this office before the national campaign got there. And these tiny little towns. But then Bill Clinton has been to more towns, and he'll come to town for 5 minutes, and these are these little towns that people think are forgotten and that the state's forgotten about, or that the national government's forgotten about, and they see Clinton walk through and give a 5-minute speech at the train depot, and I think people feel like they're getting paid attention to.
And who doesn't love getting paid attention to, right? You can see Campbell Robertson's comic strips in the multimedia section at thenewyorktimes.com. Thanks for joining us, Campbell Robertson of The New York Times. The polls, we should remind you, are now open in North Carolina and Indiana.
And right now we're going to return to the story of what's happening in Myanmar. And as you can imagine, Burmese communities all over the United States have been closely following the aftermath of the cyclone. With communication so severely hampered, very few, John, have managed to connect with family members. And that is the case for Maya Tay at the Rangoon Burmese restaurant in Philadelphia. Her mother is one of the three co-owners, and the staff there has been trying to connect with family overseas and collect money for relief efforts. Maya, your father lives in Burma. Have you been able to find him?
No, but I got in contact with my cousin yesterday around 3 o'clock here. So it'll be 3 o'clock in the morning for them. I got into contact with them. She said my father is fine, but I am trying to call again today, but he's going to be at my cousin's house. I can speak to him because there's no electricity there. There's no running water. The only people that have the electricity is with their own generator.
Wow, so you're very fortunate that there's been some communication there, and your mother has also talked to other family members. And what are they telling you?
It's really bad. They're, you know, people are looting. People are just sitting outside, sleeping on the street because there's no homes. It's just, you know, like they're really hungry out there. There's no food.
What are some of your friends in Philadelphia going through? Can you describe their efforts to connect with friends and family in Myanmar?
Well, of course, they're all worried. They call and trying to see, find out, because they can't get in contact with their own family, so they're trying to see if any of us is in contact with our family. So they ask some of us for help to help them find, you know, to see if their family's still alive and try to see if, you know, their homes are still there. So there's a couple of lists of phone numbers and where my cousin lives. She's going to go out there and try to find to see if they're still, you know, still alive or if they're still there.
Maya Tay, are people inside Myanmar criticizing the government, saying what some U.S. officials are saying, that the government didn't warn them, that it's been too slow to respond?
Which is true, because they had known, like, maybe like 3 days ahead of time, and they already moved all their airplanes, everything, you know. But there's no warning to the public, and no one knew about this until the storm arrived.
Now, what's the plan for you and your family in Philadelphia, other people that you know who have connections to the country? Are you going to raise money? Are you going to give it to an organization? How are you planning on moving forward as a group?
Right now, they just planted the three women among themselves, but they don't want to, you know, get involved with any association. They just want to make sure all the money gets to Burma, which is hard right now.
Why not get involved with organizations that are on the ground there?
I don't know. I guess they're just worried that there's going to be, you know, fraud or anything. They just, you know,
Interesting. Humanitarian aid.
Go strictly to the people that really need.
Mm-hmm. Humanitarian aid is difficult in a climate of political crackdown and a certain level of cynicism, as Maya Tay was saying, about corruption taking place. Well, thank you very much. What's the name of your restaurant?
Rangoon.
And
the phone number, if anyone's out there trying to help, the phone number is 215-829-8939.
Thank you, Maya Tay. At Philadelphia is where that restaurant is, at Rangoon. And you can get more information on our website, how to get money to organizations now coordinating relief for Myanmar. And we'd also like to ask you to inspire us. Tell us when you've given to a good cause. That's the takeaway question for today. We've had some responses, but we'd love to hear more stories. What was a single event or experience that made you open your wallet?
And, of course, you can give that to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You know, even though we go off the air periodically, you've noticed that we do go off the air periodically. We want you to stay.
Yeah, we go home.
We want to stay on your mind.
See our families.
We want to stay on your mind. And the way we do that is at thetakeaway.org. There's all kinds of stuff you can find at thetakeaway.org. Besides the takeaway question today, there's video of my scooter trip in Brooklyn. There's a video of the people at the ATMs today who our producer Jim Colgan asked when they would open their wallets. And 877-8-MY-TAKE. We can hear a comment from you, a snarky comment from you.
Yeah, we'll take the good ones,
useful
the good
comment.
Comments, and the
yes.
bad comments.
Yeah, we certainly had some bad comments, right? But you know how to reach us, and we know how to find you at the table.
We read them all, rest assured.
Yeah, I don't.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.